I decided that before episode 50, my goal was to murder Chris. And now I've done that.
You have.
So now we're doing a show with just you and me.
Well, hold on a second. I want some juicy details. Have you hidden his corpse in the studio?
No, I flayed him alive, and I have him on display.
Okay. Sous vide?
Of course.
He was really into that.
I like how seamlessly he transitioned into his past life, where he's now dead.
Well, that's what you said. I'm taking you at your word. Rest in peace, Chris. Worry not. I will have some true barbecue in your honor, and I might even
maybe you should barbecue him.
Maybe I'll even sous vide the barbecue.
The ultimate insult. This is true barbecue.
Winner. It really whips the llama's ass.
Rick, obviously you recognize that.
Of course I recognize that. Anybody that grew up in the late 90s recognizes that.
So Winamp is now available as a JS, as a JavaScript app on a website. How great is that?
I mean, they're just finally making their full transition because, you know, Winamp 2.0 or whatever was a desktop app. And then 3.0 was a desktop app, but the entire UI was based around web stuff. And then 5.0 was even more of that. So now they just got rid of the desktop app.
Dude, I love this. We're going to have a link in the show notes. But this, I grew up with Winamp. And it was funny because when I started researching radio stations, and I was like, oh, this, you know, group wants to hire me to consult for a radio station. I don't really know that much about it. I should learn a little bit about it. You'd be surprised how many tiny little radio stations are automating their systems using Winamp. And I'm like, man, Winamp, yeah, I remember that back from the 90s. I didn't know that was still a thing. Then I found out they're rewriting it from scratch, actually.
There's people making audio players that, you know, are reminiscent of Winamp on Linux still today.
If Winamp ever came to Linux, I would dedicate like a whole week worth of episode. I would do one episode every single day for a whole week just about the greatness of Winamp and the plugins for Winamp and all the things you can do with Winamp. I remember when Winamp, one of the first times I ever really looked back to Winamp, it came out and then it kind of went away and I wasn't really paying attention. And then I bought my first iPod and I didn't want to install iTunes because iTunes, like, it like took over your computer and like associated all of your files with QuickTime and it just did all these random things. And I was like, well, I wonder how I could put music on this music player that I bought. And I remember there was a plugin for Winamp at the time, and you could set it up to manage all of your whole music library. And I fell in love with Winamp all over again. And I just, man, I hear that little Winamp, that whatever you want to call it, jingle, I guess. And I get all nostalgic. And what can I say? I'm a 90s kid.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I moved on from Winamp in the mid-2000s to FUBAR 2000.
Really?
And I've never looked back.
Oh, you're still using it?
Yeah.
I'm surprised. I would think that you'd do like cloud-based music. I wouldn't have pictured you for much of a local guy. Local music.
For music, pretty much I'm a local guy. I mean,
really?
You can still get lossless audio locally, Noah.
Hey, let's talk about that. So I read an article today that says Best Buy is going to stop selling audio CDs. And, you know, so when I was talking to Rikai before the show, we're talking about things we're going to talk about. And, you know, as a guy who makes a lot of money buying music and then playing it professionally, we can't buy compressed audio. It has to be uncompressed. It has to sound good. And so I was really concerned. I was like, you know, how am I going to get uncompressed audio anymore? And Rikai, you were telling me you can actually buy a lot of this online.
You can get it from, Apple Music or Amazon. A lot of them have lossless audio options these days.
Really? And so I'm just doing a Google search. Actually, it looks like there's a lot of sites that sell lossless audio. I was not aware of this. So this is something that's actually been around for a while. And you can actually, it looks like the primary format is FLAC, of all things. How weird is that? I just think that's cool. I mean, leave it to the old curmudgeon not to know that you can use that cloud-based internet service to download all of your new uncompressed audio. You don't have to buy it on the compact disc and rip it by hand.
Well, it's good because, you know, everybody's stopping selling the compact disc, so.
Yeah. I'm going to miss now, it. Although, to be fair, I don't have, like, if you gave me a compact disc, I'd have no way to play that audio on my laptop. Like, I don't even have an optical drive. Not even, like, an external one I could plug in. In fact, it's funny, we actually dealt with this at Linux Fest Northwest last year. We had, like, Angela was the only person that had, like, a USB drive that we could use. Pretty crazy stuff.
You might check out a site called HD Tracks. They have a crap ton of music.
Really? HDTracks.com. Oh, yeah. Here we are. Look at that. Yeah. Thank you, Beard.
So, Noah, your secret's out.
My secret?
You're using Windows.
I'm what?
Everybody heard it on the Ask Noah show.
Oh, that. Here's the thing. You know what's so frustrating about that? Last week, we were doing a live episode of Linux Unplugged, and I was having so much trouble with my laptop that I jokingly said I was going to install Windows. And then the very next week, I end up installing KDE, and the power sound, if you haven't heard, sounds very Windows 10-like for some reason. And as I was going to get on the air, I hear my intro music playing, and I unplug my laptop and turn around and set it down in front of the microphone. And that stupid noise plays. And then Chris and Wes both assume that I was on Windows 10. You assume that I'm on Windows 10. And by the time that I talked to you about it, I guess I was kind of sick of justifying, like being like, no, it's KDE. So when you told me about it, I just kind of went along with it. I'm like, yeah, I installed Windows 10. I just, you know, got sick of Linux. And like, and what was shocking to me was you just went along with it. You're like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm not surprised, dude. I kind of saw that coming for a while. And then you were like, I think you were ramping up to like give me advice. You're like, yeah, well, welcome to the dark side. And you know, I'm like, that didn't shock you at all.
No, I mean, why would it?
Because I'm the zealot. I'm the
piece
guy
of garbage. And
but no,
I feel like you eventually have to break down and just be practical. Linux can't do everything.
That's true.
Nothing can do everything.
That's true.
And there's just some things that Windows can do better.
That's true. Let me ask you this. Do you think that I would still do a show where every week I'm going on telling people that they should be using Linux, but then I'm not using Linux myself? Could you see me doing that? And then not, but you know, like giving people other advice for things that I wouldn't do?
Well, firstly, I wouldn't say that you would have to stop using Linux completely. You could just have Windows as a component of your lifestyle.
Hmm. But then would it be fair?
Windows is a lifestyle choice?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Nobody's born into it. It's not a religion. It's a lifestyle choice. It's much deeper than that. Your operating system, you're born with an inclination to use one operating system or the other, clearly. So my message would have to change, right? Like, right now, every time somebody calls the show, I tell them to do what I would do. And so right now I choose Linux for everything, so that's what I tell them to do. But if I was going to choose Windows, then I'd have to start tailoring my advice differently, right?
I suppose. I mean, you could tell them that your preference would be that they would use Linux, but you know, sometimes Linux just is going to fall short. And maybe it won't fall short in the future, but yeah. In the meantime, you can do this.
Feel like I spent a good 50 weeks telling people the exact opposite. Like, I've gone so far that we have a t-shirt design. I haven't found out how to do it. I really don't know how to do it. I don't actually know how to buy a bunch of t-shirts without spending like $600. But like, we actually designed a t-shirt that says something along the lines of, I'm here to do everything on Linux they said I couldn't do on Linux. Because it seems like every time I turn around, somebody's like, Bob, you can't do that on Linux. And then I do it on Linux. And then they're like, oh, well, it turns out you can do it on Linux.
Well, I mean, on the flip side, you've also spent 50 episodes justifying GNOME and you're on KDE now.
That is somewhat true, but not entirely. Like, I spent 50 episodes defending Ubuntu and Ubuntu's decision to choose GNOME, but I don't know that I suppose that's the implication, isn't it? That if I...
Kind of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, not only that, but you also went in on GNOME too yourself, didn't you? So much so that you got sick of it and saw KDE.
Okay, how about this? How about the true measure of intelligence is you can react one of two ways. You either justify why you continue to make the same decisions you make, or you change when new information becomes available and you can't make a compelling argument anymore. Like, I was on board the GNOME train until information came to light to me that exemplified GNOME wasn't a superior choice. And as a rational human being with intelligence, like I feel like I have an obligation to myself and a responsibility to the listeners to say, this information has come to light. Here's why. Here's the information in its entirety, and here's how I'm reacting to that information, and what I think you should do. Don't you think I owe that to people?
I mean, I suppose so, but I mean, shouldn't you apply that same philosophy to things being much more difficult on Linux for certain things?
That's a good point. So I guess my rationale has always been, or my thinking along those lines has always been, as a person who has spent literally 15 years supporting systems for businesses and individuals and stuff like that, I have watched business after business burn through tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars because of problems on Windows or licensing issues or whatever it is, security issues. And I've seen minor inconveniences on Linux, but I've never seen anything show-stopping. Like, you know, the most severe thing is, well, we can't use the same program that we used before. We have to use this other program. But never is it Linux cost us $10,000 because of somebody broke into this thing or whatever, you know?
At the same time, like, you brush over that like that's a small thing. In some cases, not being able to use a certain program and having a different alternative with mm-hmm. a different feature set mm-hmm. is a really big problem.
Yeah, I agree. So I do agree. I think that from a user perspective, because it's a personal computer, and I think the personal gets lost in the discussion of they're just tools or it's not a religion or whatever. You know, I think we lose that sometimes. So in that respect, I definitely agree. I think that the user's experience definitely counts for something. But
well, not only that, but there's something to be said for disrupting a workflow.
Yes, that's true. But I guess where I try to, especially in the world that I live in, like the vast majority of places that I'm doing that are hiring me are businesses, and they measure the disruption in workflow as how much money did we lose on waiting for so-and-so to figure out how to do it in LibreOffice instead of Microsoft Office. And that dollar amount is just peanuts compared to what they spend in licensing alone for Microsoft Office. And, you know, it's funny. I was actually dealing with this earlier this week. It's like a stock trading company, essentially. And we switched them to LibreOffice in preparation for the transition to Linux. And they actually having a problem right now where they can't import the contacts from their spreadsheet to generate these address labels. And so it's an issue that I'm currently working through. And it just comes to mind as it is a problem, and it definitely has delayed them. And no doubt there's probably some dollar amount that we could put on the fact that you've paid this girl to try to figure this stuff out. And, you know, certain things didn't get sent out, or maybe a bill got paid late or something like that. There is definitely something to be said. I'm not saying that's invalid, but it certainly was nowhere near the 300 some dollars they would have had to spend for an entire MS Office license. And really times six, I think, because it's a small office of like six computers. So I guess I kind of weigh it that different. I weigh that a little bit differently. And then I start looking, you know, and then from the personal side, it's not so much a money thing. I just start to look at, well, what does it cost when you lose your data or when the computer totally crashes or something like that and you lose videos of your kids? And so I start to weigh it that way. But I fully admit it's very much a subjective experience. It's kind of, you know, that's been my experience doing the things that I'm doing, and I've come to view the world a certain way, and that it is very much a subjective thing, and certainly we're all shaped by our subjective experiences.
I will give you credit. As a business, when you're pitching Linux, you will like put down your own money to like have bugs fixed to get something working for somebody.
Yeah, or buy hardware sometimes. In the case of sometimes printers don't work or scanners, we throw that in.
Yeah. But I think the part where I have more issue is when you advocate using Linux almost unilaterally to individuals that you aren't directly supporting.
Yeah.
Because in that case, you're kind of leaving them with the buck when something doesn't work mm-hmm. as they expected.
Yeah, not only that, the support infrastructure that they would have with Windows or Mac OS or, you know, or even Chromebooks, really – it doesn't exist. If you take a Linux computer to Best Buy and say, I don't know how to open my music or what program do I use, Best Buy is going to be able to answer that question on a MacBook or on a Windows PC or on a Chromebook. They're not going to be able to answer that question on a Linux computer, right?
Yeah, the closest you'll get is something like System 76, but even that, like, they're a small company. They're not going to be able to give the same level of service that somebody like Dell with a Windows computer would. I mean, I guess there's the Dell Linux computers now, but I don't know how their support stuff is.
Yeah, and the most popular aspect of that is going to be people are going to go out and buy like HPs and Compacs and old ThinkPads and stuff like that. And there has to be a support infrastructure in place. And I guess, you know, if I'm being honest, that was the whole premise of the Ask Noah show, was to give that community resource back to the community and say, okay, here is going to be the pillar, the cornerstone. If you have problems with those machines, if you're trying to get that stuff to work and you need a resource, if you need a helping hand to reach out to, or if you need, you know, if there's, you know, there's a guy I was emailing with, he needed an audio card, so we're shipping him an audio interface so that he can, you know, use his audio card under Linux. Little stuff like that. That's my way of kind of giving back. And so, like you said, if I'm going to go on the air and advocate for all this stuff, man, I better be willing to back that up when those people run into problems, because I am depriving them of the support infrastructure they would have if they took the path more traveled.
Yeah, and I guess again, to your credit, Ask Noah does do that, but I feel like at the same time you can't like give one-on-one support for an extended period of time, so it's not really an equivalent to calling like 1-800-Microsoft or
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I wonder, maybe that's a business opportunity. Like maybe, you know, yeah, $99 a year and we'll give you a toll-free 24-hour toll-free number that you can call and get personalized one-on-one help.
Yeah, it might be a thing. I think you might need to hire some more people out though.
Yeah, Rikai, are you looking for a spare job? You're like the best Googler I know.
Let's do it.
You'd be like tier 3 support, right? Like I pay one guy, like we hire some guy, pay him like peanuts. He can work in India or whatever, and the people can call him and he'll be like, you restart computer, light on, okay, all right, tier 2, and then you know we hire some guy from the community and
tier 2, you get to Canada.
Yeah, Canada. and they don't use any sort of they don't use any pronouns with the name man in them. I don't know if you saw that from Justin Trudeau today.
We'll hire Dustin.
Yes.
He's Canadian, right?
Okay. All right. So he can start, and then when they get above Dustin, then they get to you. Then they get to Rikai. And Rikai is like it's like tier 3 god support. And they get
I come on the line, you just hear knuckles cracking. All right. Here's your solution.
I've Googled, and here's what you do.
All right, Noah, are you ready to abandon Google for another giant multi-billion dollar company that has no personal love for you
and will
probably destroy your life?
Yes.
Because I hear Intel has their own Google Glass.
They do. They have Intel Vaunt. And what's interesting about Intel Vaunt is it's Intel's take.
It's vulnerable to Spectre and Meltdown. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe. It's Intel's take at Google Glass, and I measure my life in before Glass and after Glass. I really liked Google Glass. I still really like Google Glass. I still use it here in Grand Forks. I just can't really travel with it, and I'm sure at some point it's going to become, you know, totally unusable. But Intel Vaunt is Intel's take on the smart glasses thing. And what's interesting about Intel Vaunt is they've taken away probably the one thing I like the most, and that's the camera, which is incidentally also what made like most people really nervous about being around people with Google Glass, right? But Intel Vaunt is augmented reality smart glasses. And what's interesting, the other thing that Intel did that was really interesting is they have a projection system that has to be tuned to your eye. So what they can do is that you have to go in to Intel's lab and they put these glasses on you and they poke you up to this machine and they measure like your retina or whatever. And then they tune this little projector thing so that you can actually see the screen. So if you're just looking in normal conversation, you don't see anything out of the ordinary. It just looks like normal glasses. But if you get a notification, you can choose to look down in a specific area of the glass. And only when you're looking at that area can you actually see the notification. So it's their take on can we provide notifications when you want them, but the ability without them being intrusive. So I'm kind of watching it. And without the camera, it doesn't seem as useful to me. Like that was the big thing to me was I could just say, Google Glass, take a picture. And boom, I captured that moment. And that was my kids doing something ridiculously cute, or that was something that was like, you know, jaw-dropping or whatever in public. And I could take those pictures and it was inconspicuous. And it was quick and it was available, and it was kind of like a video or picture journal, if you will. And I really miss that. And I don't think smart glasses would be as useful or as compelling to me without the camera. But Intel Vaunt, they don't have a price available, and it's not actually even for sale right now. They're giving some demo units out to people, but you have to go to their lab to get them fit for your eyes. So I don't know. They definitely look less geeky than Google Glass. I'll give them that.
Don't worry. There's going to be like in a year, you're going to be able to go to like your optometrist and they'll measure your eye when they're getting your prescription. And then you'll just be able to get it from there.
Yeah, I hope so. I really wish somebody would come up with one of the camera. I bought the Vuvix. By the way, I'm selling them if anyone's interested. I have the Vuvix. I think that's how you pronounce it. And it's like a modern Android implementation of Google Glass. And they're okay for what they do, but they have this obnoxious blinking red light anytime the camera goes, which is frustrating and draws a lot of unwanted attention to you. It's just weird. So I'm going to put them up for sale on eBay, I think, in the next week or so.
Here's the real question, Noah. What OS is it running and how much can you hack it?
The Intel one runs a specialized version of Linux. I think that the Vuvix ones runs Android. And, of course, Google Glass runs Android. Yeah, it doesn't say. It just says the Vaunt will connect with iOS and Android devices and pull the wearer's notification similar to a smartwatch. The designers intend the wearers to be able to quickly glance at the bottom right of the corner of their eyeglasses to check for news and text without having to visibly pull out a phone or glance at their wrist. So it doesn't really say. But I read somewhere that it was Linux.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. What do you think the architecture is? Because obviously, probably not ARM.
Why wouldn't it be ARM?
Because it's an Intel device?
That doesn't stop it from being ARM, though. We live in a world where Intel has AMD on their chips.
Yeah. I just feel like Intel's designing something. I mean, you'd think that a chip manufacturer would make a chip to go inside of the thing that they're selling. I mean, that's there's no camera. That's really all it is a specialized display with the chip. Well,
there's also nothing that stops Intel from making ARM chips, though.
Yeah, that's true. They should do that. Why are they not doing that? Are they doing that? They should be doing that.
I don't know. Probably conflict of interest or something.
You know, my mother always used to tell me the one thing that people can't take away from you is your knowledge. And with Linux Academy's great deal, when you go over to linuxacademy.com/unplugged, you'll get a 7-day free trial and you can load your brain up for free for those first 7 days. And let me tell you, Linux Academy has everything. It's a platform to make your mind better about Linux. I get people every single week that call me and say, Noah, how can I make more money? How can I start my next career in the IT infrastructure? Well, with Linux Academy, you have hands-on real experience, the stuff that builds confidence. And with the labs that they spin up for you, they'll take care of all the heavy lifting, all of the hard work. So all you have to focus on is filling your brain with knowledge, picking up the material, learning it. One of the most frustrating things when you're trying to get your head wrapped around a new piece of technology is all of the other things that you have to do to be able to play with that technology. I've gone through times where I need to spin up just to get the technology that I want to play with. I have to set up a web server and I have to set up certs and I have to, you know, set up all of these things. And it's not that I'm not capable or not smart enough to do it. My headspace is just in the, I want to learn these things. Well, Linux Academy, they take care of all of that for you and they stay on top of the latest trends. These aren't just people that they paid to teach Linux. I mean, I think they do get paid and they definitely do teach Linux, but these are industry professionals that have lived this stuff. They eat and breathe this stuff and then they share that knowledge with you. But the best part is they're humans. And they have real human interactions and real human instructors. And the advantage to that is you can ask questions. Learning is a two-way street. It's not just a one-way thing. And that's what sets Linux Academy apart from YouTube tutorials and stuff like that, is they will assign an instructor to you and you can ask that instructor and get feedback and move forward and build your next career in Linux. So go to linuxacademy.com/unplugged and try it for free for 7 days. I promise you at the end of that 7 days, you're going to renew because you just can't get enough. linuxacademy.com/unplugged. And a huge thanks to Linux Academy for sponsoring this episode of User Error.
All right, Noah. So over the past couple weeks, I've been on a bit of an adventure. I felt bad that I missed the Bitcoin bubble, which in retrospect now...
which was in fact a bubble.
Which in retrospect, apparently now I'm glad I missed that because it's crap again.
Well, it depends on when you jumped in, right?
Yeah, I suppose. Well, I would have jumped in way back in the day, but it's okay because I'm going to make more money anyway.
Okay.
I've gone and I've dove into altcoins, Noah.
You went.
I talked about it a little bit last week, but I went to Bitcoin Talk. They have an altcoin forum. I went through there. I did some research, and I found a coin that I decided I was going to bet my electricity bill on.
Pokecoin?
Wait, Pokecoin?
Yeah. Is that not what you landed on?
Ravencoin.
Ravencoin. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. And Ravencoin, that's one that's not even on the exchange yet, right?
Nope.
But you can still buy it. But you can buy it if you go to if you go into like their Discord or whatever, right?
Or their Telegram.
Okay.
But yeah, so I figured I'd just talk a little bit about what it's like getting involved in one of these coins really early on and some of the stuff you see.
Okay.
So when I got there, Ravencoin had already been out for like a week and a half.
Okay, let's start with this. What was it that led you to Ravencoin? So you're looking into all of these coins. There's all these different options. Just like I'm on like one of my favorite websites for researching crypto coins, and I'm just looking. There are 400 some cryptocurrencies that are being actively traded. So I'm sure there's much more than that because these are just the ones that are listed on the exchanges. What originally drew you to Ravencoin?
Well, first of all, the fact that it wasn't on an exchange.
Okay. So it hasn't started yet. So you can get in like at the beginning.
Yeah. Although I didn't because I came in after a week after the blockchain started. I think it started on January 6th or 9th or something.
Okay.
But it was relatively early. So, you know, I still had time to get some coins in. But more so than that, unlike a lot of what the community refers to as shit coins,
okay,
it seems like it has a lot of backing from like major players in the community. Like one of the guys that backs it is a member of the Bitcoin Foundation.
Yes, okay,
which I think is a decent level of credibility to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely,
and. At least from the other people in the community that I've been talking to, they're seeing a lot of face like really old school Bitcoin users that they recognize the names of from like back in 2011 being interested in this coin. Mm-hmm. And something that it's trying to do, they haven't really fleshed out the details because they launched. And then after they launched, they realized that they needed to get some stuff in order because it turns out launching a blockchain isn't the easiest thing in the world.
Sure.
So they've been busy with that. And then after that, they had a conference, which actually just wrapped up. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's a Bitcoin conference that has a lot of the big names that took place in New Hampshire that they went to. So they actually they launched the coin and then they peaced out for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
But the good thing about Raven is even though the main developers were gone, the community has been doing a lot of stuff. They've been setting up various pools and working out how to do the whole trading stuff that you were talking about. Like all that's community run.
Mm-hmm.
So early on, I got the experience of mining a coin on a CPU, which is something you don't often get to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because by the time most people get to a coin, the difficulty is already way up there, so you need a GPU.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is what I'm doing now because the difficulty has spiked.
Sure.
One of the things I found interesting is one of the things that drew me to Ravencoin is that a lot of the coins that are coming out now are starting off with these ICOs, initial coin offerings.
Okay.
Where you basically buy in to the coin before it even launches. Like you pay money and you get pre-mined coins, essentially.
Okay.
And that's like a crap load of the coins now. And it's becoming a problem to the point where recently there was a coin that had an ICO that was busted by the federal government because apparently they didn't meet the standards for one of those initial offerings, I guess. I could be wrong in the details of that. I'll link that in the show notes as well. But yeah, so one of the things about Raven is they didn't do an ICO, and they just put the blockchain up and said, here you go. They even went to different conferences like several months ahead of time and announced, hey, you know, we're planning to launch this. This is going to launch on this date, and you can start mining then. And some people did. But one thing I found interesting reading through the Bitcoin talk thread, because Ravencoin didn't get posted immediately on Bitcoin talk, there is a small group of people that have decided that this coin is a scam, and that it although it's listed as not being pre-mined.
Oh, brother.
Apparently, that means because it wasn't listed on Bitcoin talk, that means the developers took tons of time and pre-mined a bunch of coins. But there was literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people already on the network before it was posted on Bitcoin talk. So, like, it was publicly known. Just people in the Bitcoin talk bubble are just like, you know, it wasn't posted here, so clearly it's a scam.
You know, that's pretty typical of the internet user base. You know, you gotta find something to fight about. Gotta find something to complain about. It can't just be these people doing a cool thing. There's always got to be a hidden agenda, right?
There's also, you know, I think that Bitcoin talk has this strange monopoly on mindshare in the Bitcoin altcoin community, because it feels like if stuff isn't posted there, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's probably fair.
And that's I feel like that's probably a problem with the community that they should look into solving, because that's a whole lot of centralization on one place.
Well, so it is, but it's community centralization, right? So for example, years ago when we used to hire people, when I first started AltaSpeed, I'd look at certifications, right? And I'd say what certification those people have, and that's what let me know that they could do the job. These days I have something way more valuable than certifications, and that is an online media reputation, or an online, social media reputation. And so when I go and see somebody and they say, well, they've been contributing to this project and they really know their stuff here and they're working with these people and those people and these people vouch for them, and I know I can trust that person to do the job because they've established themselves. So to a certain degree, it is a form of centralization, but it's a form of centralization that exists, I think, from the standpoint of they build a reputation. You know, these various sites say these are the reputable sources for cryptocurrency talk. And so when a cryptocurrency comes on the market, they need to have an established reputation or build an established reputation on this particular site, or it's no good.
I mean, I suppose, but like, I think the problem in this case is that it feels like the community that has built around Bitcoin talk is hostile to the creation of other communities.
Yeah, I suppose. Well, they have a vested interest in being hostile to other communities, right?
But do they, though?
I don't know. Well, don't they want their own coins to, you know, the coins that they have to succeed?
I mean, but there's nothing stopping those coins from being listed on these other places.
Yeah, fair.
They want to expand their reach?
Yeah, and establish themselves as a central place for new cryptocurrencies when they come on the market, right?
I don't think it's so much the coin creators that have a problem with other platforms either. I think it's the users of like the community of this forum kind of seems just hostile to other communities existing.
Sure. Yeah.
But that aside, it's been interesting seeing Ravencoin grow. I got on there just after the first mining pool opened,
mm-hmm.
Which was called Supernova,
mm-hmm.
And there's a site called Ravenstats.info, RVNstats.info, and if you go there now, it's not so bad. But back when it first started, they basically dominated the hash rate of the coin, which is, if you know anything about altcoins and bitcoins and all that stuff, having one place that dominates the hash rate is very unhealthy and very mm-hmm. risky.
Right.
So what ended up happening is the community in the Discord, they put up another community-centric made from within the community pool called Three-Eyed Raven. Mm-hmm. It's a reference to Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. So slowly over the course of like weeks, you would see on Raven stats just the community pool taking up and up and up and up and up. And now it's the one that's the problem. It has too much of the hash rate.
Sure.
But there's like five or six pools now, so that's pretty good.
Huh.
So I guess after that, the next most interesting thing is that Ravencoin launched with a new algorithm called X16R, which is based on the X11 through X15 algorithms. They added another algorithm, and they also added randomization. And they used, the last 8 bytes of the previous block to decide what the next block's algorithm grouping is going to be. The problem with that is they've launched a new algorithm, which means all the miners don't have the they don't have the miners complete. So immediately people were like, okay, I want to GPU mine this so I can get a crap ton of coins. And there were miners that were capable of doing some of it, but not all of it. So there's still no AMD miner at all, which is good for NVIDIA people, I guess. But when you use the NVIDIA miner, up until as I think like 5 days ago, when they finally came out with a complete GPU miner, you would mine part of the thing with your GPU, and then it would fall back to your CPU, which actually caused a lot of problems for a lot of people, because people build these minimum spec systems with a crap ton of GPUs in them to mine this stuff. And the problem with that is if you have a crap CPU, it's going to negatively affect your mining. Wow. So that's something that was interesting to watch. Like over the course of weeks, you just kept seeing more and more demand of people wanting a complete miner. And it also caused other strange things to go on. Like the difficulty was kind of all over the place, because the hash rate of the entire network depended on what algorithms were being used at a given time. So you'd see the hash rate go up and up and down and up and down. And it was really interesting to see something like that. But another thing that caused a problem with that is there were private miners off the pools. So nobody had any like indication of who they were or what they were doing. But it seemed like they had privately funded a completed miner, and they were privately using it to get a crap ton of coins, while everybody else that was not privy to that miner was getting coins at a much slower rate. Mm. And that was driving up the difficulty of the network. And so that was a problem that kind of has evaporated since they've gotten the completed miner.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a big deal, because not only would they drive up the difficulty, but then they would they'd bail on the coin. And that would leave this really high difficulty rate. And I think it's I think the difficulty adjusts every 2018 blocks or 2017 blocks.
Mm-hmm.
So they dump on the coin, and suddenly the hash rate would drop massively, because they were bringing in like double or triple the entire network's hash rate. And so the hash rate would drop, but the difficulty would still be high. So you'd have this really long period of time where you would have all these people that were legitimately mining. I mean, I guess the other people are legitimately mining too, but they have an advantage. But these people would mine with the incomplete miner, and it would take a very long time to get through those blocks. And that pissed off a lot of people, but there's not really anything you can do about it. So I think the lesson to be learned there is if you're going to launch a coin, make sure you've got your GPU miner complete before you launch your coin. Otherwise, you know, you have people that are privately raking in tons of coins that you can't do anything about other than, you know, maybe banning the coin or something, or getting something out there. But luckily we had one of the larger developers of CC Miner, which is the NVIDIA GPU miner, fix or finish implementing all the algorithms. So that got fixed as of a few days ago. Another thing that was nice to see that kind of gives me good feelings about the Ravencoin community is part of getting that miner made was, you know, paying the guy to put in the massive amount of time of effort that it takes to program a CUDA accelerated miner. So there's a lot of community efforts to pump up some officially announced dev wallets to, you know, give people Ravencoin bounties to get the GPU miner finished. And some of those worked out pretty well. And in some cases, you know, there was, you know, private individuals that also, you know, decided to match some of that stuff, which is pretty cool. You know, it just shows, like, you know, a very community focused spirit to the coin, which is, again, something you don't see in a lot of the coins, because, you know, a lot of them are just made to, hey, let's see if we can get some value out of this. And if we don't, we'll abandon it. If we do, we'll maybe make some money.
I hate people that approach cryptocurrency that way, too. I think that's the wrong attitude. And I think that the community-based attitude is the right way to go. And it surprised me, because I see all these crazy stories about people, like, taking second mortgages out on their houses and stuff like that. And it's like, man, I mean, there's great ways to experience crypto and to play with crypto and to be involved with crypto. That just isn't one of them.
Yeah, it was pretty nice. You know, you got to see you had various different developers, like, competing, like, friendly competition, but they were competing to see who could get their miner finished. You know, eventually one dude won, but it was, you know, the community wallets that people donated to gave them incentive to want to do this instead of, you know, just doing it out of the kindness of their heart, which I'm sure they probably would have done as well, because, you know, they're good people. But it's nice to have, you know, additional incentive for those people, so they're not just burning hours of their free time that they could spend, you know, making money and stuff. Yeah, so they still need someone to create an AMD miner. So if anybody out there is interested in maybe reaping a bounty, and you happen to know, like, OpenCL, you could start working based off of the SG miner code base, and maybe you could get a whole bunch of Ravencoin for yourself if you're too late to mine them already. But yeah, so just in the past couple days, things have started to look pretty healthy across the board for the coin. The miner's completed, the hash rate's decently spread out. It's not perfect, but it's getting better. A lot more people, especially in, like, the past 24 to 48 hours, have been jumping onto the coin. And yeah, I'm just really looking forward to seeing where it goes. The developers are working on hashing out exactly how they want the asset transfer part of the coin to work, and I think they're going to give more info on that soon. But yeah, I guess I honed in on this coin because it feels like it has, like, the details may be not very clear at the moment about, like, how they're going to do the asset transfer and stuff, but it feels like the coin has a good base. It has intelligent developers. It has a good community, it seems like it's continually growing. Even without the exchanges and without the asset transfer stuff hashed out, you still got the coin like trading between people for like 2 cents a piece, which is actually really high for something with so little information. So I feel like it's a coin that might take a while to get there, but it's going to grow quite a lot.
Well, I hope you'll keep track of that. I'm following Bitcoin and some of the altcoins on the Ask Noah show, but really I haven't dug into it nearly that deep, and you clearly have a much, you know, at a technical level, a better understanding of the intricacies of it. So I'd be interested to hear how that goes.
Yeah. So, do you have any interest in altcoins beyond the idle pick a random coin in mine?
I have an interest in Ravencoin, if only because I want to do mining with you and I want to set up like a Ravencoin mining system, and just as a for no other reason, because I like the technical challenge of it. And the idea of, like, can I set up hardware and then have somebody else remotely administrate the hardware to mine coins? And if it happens to ever get any money, that'd be great too. But yeah, from that perspective, I'm interested.
That's kind of how I feel about Ravencoin. Like, obviously, I would like to make some money out of it. You know, money's good. But I feel like it feels like a coin that, in addition to making money out of it, I would also like to see it succeed at what it's trying to do, because it just feels like there are too many kind of pump and dump kind of coins out there. Like, if you go to the altcoin threads, it took me a while to find Ravencoin. I kind of got lucky because I just stumbled upon it. But you can go through pages and pages of coins where it's just like, hey, this is basically just a clone of this other coin, and we haven't really done anything new with it. And I'm just gonna advertise this and see how many people jump on, and see if I can make some money, get it listed on an exchange, and then dump it all.
Well, there you go. I think that might go against exactly what I was just saying you shouldn't do. Yeah. Get involved with cryptocurrency, but hey, you know what? If it works for you, more power to you. Especially if it gets you some money to improve your living situation.
Yeah. But I will keep you guys updated. Right now, there's not a lot going on. I'm just mining more and more, and I got 50,000 coins, so I guess that's something good.
Let's take a moment to talk about DigitalOcean, my go-to for server hosting. Actually, this week in particular, I have spent more time on DigitalOcean. Right before I went on the air to do my program, I was sitting there talking with the client, and they needed some server infrastructure, and I was able to offer them, we could have the server not only up and running, but have it configured and all ready to go, because DigitalOcean has a dashboard with a console that you can get console access to the machine. It's absolutely fantastic. We had that
dashboard for days.
Dashboard for days, exactly. We had a system up and going in just under a minute on their super fast infrastructure. Everything is SSD based. And if you haven't run, you know, I remember the first time I saw a server that went down to the 2.5 inch drives, and I was like, why is that? And then I fell in love with SSDs for servers, and I haven't gone back since. You can choose whatever Linux distro you want. I hear they even have that BSD stuff for the Alan Judes of the world. You can deploy a base system, or one of my new favorite features on DigitalOcean. It's been there for a long time. I just, magic scripts, I don't use this kind of thing. The new way where you can just click on the application that you want and it sets it up. Now, the first couple of times, I was kind of a stubborn old man, and I was like, well, I'm going to set it up from scratch because magic scripts, blah. But now it's gotten to the point where it's like, we all know that we can all set up LAMP stacks. I can run through, you know, the process of setting all that all up. But if I just click the button, DigitalOcean does it for me. And
you save 2 hours.
Well, not only do you save 2 hours, Rikai, what they integrate it in such a way that when you log into that system for the first time, it gives you this interface that says, like, you've just installed, you know, a SQL system, and here is your SQL password, and here is this, and for security reasons, you should probably change this, and here's the self-generated SSL certificate we made for this kind of application. But if you want to put your paid one in or your Let's Encrypt, then go ahead and put it in this directory right here. And it lays it out just perfectly. So even if you're, especially if you're just breaking into server administration, that's a way that you can really get started. So give DigitalOcean a try. Use the code DOUNPLUGGED.
You want to know what my favorite thing about DigitalOcean is? These, the dashboard. All these new
the cheap servers?
These new, The new pricing options.
The amazing fast band. Oh, the new pricing options. Yeah, that too. Yeah, they've gotten, they're giving you more for your money. And you know what's funny was, for a while there, I was looking at some of DigitalOcean competitors going, man, I could get this much disk space for this much money. And then just a couple months later, all of a sudden, DigitalOcean blows that out of the water and goes, okay, well, now we'll give you more, even more disk space for the same $5. So now, what I was thinking, I was going to outgrow my $5 droplets. Now that they've just reset it and they're good for another 3 years because I have, I think they went, what do they go up to, 25 gigs now?
$5. Yeah, 25 gigs.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, they've reset it. And now, yet again, the hunt starts over to find something that can beat DigitalOcean.
Sorry? Even if you run out of space on that, you just spend another $5, you get those spaces.
Or use the code DOUNPLUGGED, and you can do the $10 rig for free and see if that works for you.
Yeah, and that's what, 80 gigs? No, 50 gigs.
Oh, jeez, they upgraded that one too, huh?
They upgraded all of them.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you can't beat DigitalOcean. You know, DigitalOcean has developed a reputation now where I literally get customers calling me saying, hey, we want you to spin up some infrastructure, and we were thinking we could use DigitalOcean for that. And they want to use the code DOUNPLUGGED because they know they can save a bunch of money. So DigitalOcean.com, use the code DOUNPLUGGED. And thanks to DigitalOcean for sponsoring this episode of User Error.
All right, Noah. Now, there's a new product from Nintendo, and I'm wondering if you'd buy it.
Okay. Another Game Boy? Desktop console? Computer console?
You're thinking too high-tech.
Okay. Board game?
No. Too high-tech.
Still? Oh, boy.
They're gonna charge you money.
Okay.
And they're going to ship you some cardboard.
What?
It's Nintendo labeled, and it's got some fancy lines on it, but it's just cardboard.
It's like Google Cardboard.
It's got some predefined cutouts where you will fold it in certain ways, and you will combine it with your Switch, your Nintendo Switch. But it's just cardboard.
So Nintendo is selling Google Cardboard.
Maybe.
Nintendo is selling Google Cardboard for the Nintendo Switch.
Yes, kind of. What do you think of this, and will you buy it?
That's ridiculous. No, I would never spend money on it.
All right. We're gonna pause the conversation. You're gonna watch the trailer, and these people are gonna hear a cut, and we're gonna see what you think afterwards.
Wow, that is incredible! I can't believe what I just watched. You know, I part of it is I think when you say they're gonna ship you a piece of cardboard, I think everyone envisions, you know, the Google Cardboard kind of a thing. This is not that. This is taking creativity and art, really, to a certain degree, taking creativity and art and the maker movement and combining them all into one so that you can, at a cost-effective way, build a motorcycle, build a piano, build a race car, build a house, you know, all of those things. And you could, and the only reason that's affordable for people is because it's made out of cardboard. And the only reason that it's not just dumb and a kid's toy is because it has the technology to make that thing do something really cool.
Yeah, it kind of combines the functionality of what you can do with the Switch with like the ability to make external devices that can use the Switch in special ways.
Right, like drum sets.
Yeah, so the way it works is they have They ship you the kit that you buy. Right now, I think they have two kits, the variety kit, which has most of the stuff, and the robot kit, which has the robot punchy thing that you saw in the video, which will be linked in the show notes as well. But they ship you this kit. It comes with this predefined cardboard with all the fancy drawings and stuff on it. But it also ships with a game that you put in the Switch. And then you can use the cardboard stuff, which has extra stuff. Like, if you watch the entire trailer for the robot one, it's got stuff inside that like helps it recognize the actuation and explain that to the Switch controller that you stick into it. And yeah, so that's basically how it works. It's not cheap. The variety kit is $70, and the robot kit is $80.
That is not that expensive for what you're getting.
No, I mean it's basically a slightly more than the price of a brand new game, but that's still a significant investment. It's cheap compared to like buying a piano, sure.
And a drum set, and a robot, and a motorcycle, and a race car.
Well, you know, to be fair, to get the robot and all the rest, that's closer to like $150, $200.
Okay. How much is a Switch?
A Switch, I think it's $300.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go. So, yeah, Switch $300. Do they have any first-person shooters for Nintendo? Or is that? I mean, that's been traditionally not really Nintendo's thing, right?
I believe
it was back in the GoldenEye day, but.
I believe there's a few, and if not, they're coming out soon. They have Wolfenstein: The New Colossus, which is a really good first-person shooter based in the Wolfenstein franchise.
Hmm. I wish they'd come out with the original GoldenEye. But they have Minecraft. I should totally get this for my kids.
Everything has Minecraft.
Yeah, but I could get this for my kids. Can you play like on a regular Minecraft server with Wi-Fi?
That's a good question. They recently launched something with Minecraft called I think it's Minecraft Everywhere.
Hmm.
And I think that allows you to play on servers. The Better Together update, which brings the latest requested features to more platforms. So it's compatible with the Windows 10 version. It's not compatible with the Java version.
Interesting.
The only so every console version, with the exception of the Sony version, I believe, and the Windows 10 version, are all cross-playable with each other now. The only two that aren't are the Sony release, which might have changed, I'm not sure, and the Java version because it's a different code base than all the rest.
So can the Xbox version play over a server to like on the same Linux server as, let's say, the Linux client?
No, because the Linux version is the Java version.
Okay. But the okay, and the Windows version can't connect to the Java version? Or no. Sorry, the Xbox version can't?
The Xbox version can connect to the Windows 10 version, but not the Linux version.
Gotcha. Have you played it?
The Windows 10 version is basically rebuilt from the ground up. It's written in C rather than Java, and that's essentially the basis for all the other versions.
And is that going to get ported to Linux, do you think?
I mean, it could. I doubt it will. I think the only reason Java ended up on Linux is because Java's portable.
So do you think that Minecraft is eventually going to come to an end on Linux?
No. They have said that they're going to continue to support the Java version as well for the foreseeable future because it is by far the more popular version on the PC. And people really like it because of the modding, which you can't really do on the C version. That's another benefit of Java is you can modify it a lot, and people really like their modded Minecraft. But you can't do that on the Windows 10 version. So I don't think the Java version is going away anytime soon. So you don't have to worry about that. All right, Noah, this is going to probably end up being a obvious answer. So I'm going to twist it so you're not allowed to answer what I know you're going to answer.
Okay.
If you couldn't pick Indian food, what would be the one food that you would eat for the rest of your life?
Jeez, dude. You're really going to bar Indian food out of this discussion?
Yep. Let's say you were offered a crap ton of money to only eat one food for the rest of your life or for a set period of time. What would it be? It can't be Indian food.
If it's a set period of time, those are two different questions. If it's a set period of time, it would be Chinese food. Because,
well, I mean, a long set period of time.
Yeah, that's fine. Even if it was like 20 years, it'd be Chinese food. If it was like for the rest of my life, like I literally could never eat anything else ever again, I'm probably going to go with hamburgers.
Hamburgers, huh?
I mean, yeah, I guess, because here's the thing.
I guess you can fancy them up a lot in different ways.
And that's one of my reasons. The other thing is no two hamburgers are the same. So like a McDonald's hamburger and a Burger King hamburger, and I don't know if you guys have do you guys have Carl's Jr. or Hardee's?
I've been to them before.
Okay. So those are basically three different meals.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a place called Burger Time, which makes like really good burgers. And then there's the Nook, which is I've eaten burgers all around the world, including kangaroo burgers from Australia. And the best hamburgers anywhere in the entire world are in a tiny little town in Minnesota, and a place called The Nook, which Chris has eaten there. But anyway, that's my rationale for burgers. But if it was going to be like, even if there's a limit, even if it was like 50 years, the next 50 years, I could only eat one food, it'd probably be Chinese food.
That seems like the worst answer ever to me, because you eat Chinese food and then you just feel hungry again.
That's true.
You'd like spend billions of dollars on Chinese food.
That is true. And Chinese food is really just a crappy knockup of Indian food. You know, I mean, it's not.
Now I understand why that's cheating now.
Yeah, but that's my thing. It's like, I want ethnic food that tastes really good. Interestingly enough, literally before we got on the air, I took a nap before I got off work and we were going to record this episode, and I woke up from my nap and I was like, I have craving for Thai food. So I went and got Thai food and then came and ate it at the studio while I waited for you to get done editing.
Well, I wonder, like, why wouldn't you choose Thai food over Chinese food then?
Because Thai food largely tastes all the same to me, whereas Chinese food, like a cream cheese wonton is like a totally different kind of meal than like sweet and sour chicken.
Okay, no, we need to go to some Seattle Thai food, because there's a huge variety of Thai food. I've eaten Thai food.
Remember, you picked out everything we ate the last time we had Thai in Washington.
Well, yeah, that was up in Arlington, though. That's a completely different thing. There's one Thai place. Down here in Seattle, there's like so much different Thai food.
Okay.
So I feel like you have a skewed judgment of Thai food. I think Chinese, you get that reputation because like every town or city has like six different Chinese places, so there's always variety.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I don't know. I've eaten some Thai food in some pretty big places. I've eaten Thai food in New York City. I've eaten Thai food in Jersey City. I've eaten a lot of Thai food, and I don't know. I just, yeah. Well, anyway, maybe I need to try different Thai foods, and then I'll find different things. So it seems like everything is just rice or noodles and curry.
All right. So before I answer, do you have any restrictions for me?
Of course I have restrictions for you, dude. You have to limit how many ingredients go into your milkshake. and Five Guys is out of the question.
Oh, that's easy then. Pizza.
Darn it. I should have totally caught that. I totally should have caught that. I didn't. Do you want to tell everyone about the most amazing pizza that you ever introduced me to that I can no longer get?
You can tell them.
Okay, so I was at there was a reason for that. I don't remember what, but basically I was at Self, and you were there, and you were talking. And you're like, man, I'd really like pizza, but my budget doesn't afford it this right now, so I'm not going to be able to do pizza. And I was like, I was in my head, I was like, I'll surprise him with pizza delivery. So I'm like, Rakai, what do you usually get for pizza? And you're like, oh, I get this kind of pizza. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I go on, I think it was Pizza Hut, right?
Yeah.
So I go to Pizza Hut's site and I'm ordering this pizza and I put it together and it's like a $50 order. And I'm like, wow, no wonder his budget can't afford it. Like $50 pizza like this. You remember this, right? And I'm like, wow, that's incredible. That's an incredible amount of money for one person to spend on pizza. I just can't believe that's incredible. But you know, whatever. I mean, it's not like you said, like, go spend $50 on me. I'm coming up with this. So I order this pizza and you have it delivered. And you're like, dude, thanks so much. I can't believe you did that. Blah, 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 blah. It's really great. There's just one small thing and I don't really know how to bring this up. And I'm like, what's that? And you're like, you spent $50 on it. And I'm like, well, yeah, I just added all the stuff to what you told me to do. And you're like, no, dude, you got to use this coupon code. And then it's like $18. You had this coupon code and you put the coupon code and you could get four toppings and a free order of breadsticks and a free whatever it was. I don't, but all the stuff. But we got $50 worth of food for $18. And after
back in the day, you still can, but apparently not in my location.
It's severely restricted. Go ahead and tell them what it used to be. And then I'll tell you what the crap version is that you can get today.
Used to be able to get a large and any amount of toppings pizza for $11.
Yeah, and so then you added a couple of things and it worked out, but it was great. But here was the great thing. It was honey sriracha crust, and it was mm-hmm. filled with cheese and it was amazing. And then they got rid of the honey sriracha, and then I went to garlic, which is okay for a little bit, and then they got rid of that deal almost altogether because now it's like $15 plus once you add the other things on, then it's, you know, it works out to be like 30 now. But
well, I can actually still get it here in Seattle.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Well,
so when you're visiting again, though,
It was amazing pizza. You should post that recipe. He builds his own pizza, and it is fantastic. It's one of my favorite pizzas of all times, hands down.
Yeah, it's chicken, meatball, pepperoni, Italian sausage, extra cheese, stuffed crust, sriracha.
I really like it. I think it's one, like I said, it adds to one of my favorite foods. I should have stamped out pizza, though. That is true. But you know what? Pizza, much like hamburgers, it's technically one food, but you can make pizza all different kinds of ways.
Yeah, yeah. That's my go-to when somebody asks me that, because you can just have infinite amounts of variety. So you're not technically eating one food. You can make very different pizzas that taste very different. Like, you can get a pizza that doesn't even use pizza sauce. It uses Alfredo sauce, and you have chicken on top, and suddenly it's a white pizza, and it's completely different.
Hey, Rika, I got a really cool article up on my computer.
What's that?
This is from theregister.co.uk. Here's the headline. You ready for this?
Sure.
A huge failure. Flat Earther Rocketeer can't get it up again.
Well, it turns out that somebody did get it up recently, Noah.
Oh, yeah?
I guess he took his Viagra and he just fucking launched the biggest dick ever into space.
Also known as a car.
But also on top of the largest capacity rocket that man has ever created.
So this is really cool. SpaceX, which is a company owned by Elon Musk, has built a rocket that took Elon Musk's first Tesla Roadster up to space, and his Roadster is now floating around in space. Now, what's funny was about this is, like, we live in a world in 2018. We live in a reality where a website. A man who owns a website that you can buy a flamethrower on just launched his car into space with the world's most powerful rocket. Science fiction writers are going to have a really hard time in the next couple months.
Not only is it in space, floating around, apparently it's on a trajectory towards Mars.
And there's a dummy inside looking out the window.
He's listening to Space Oddity. And on the dashboard, there is a little plaque where the radio is that says "Don't Panic," which is a reference to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, so Elon Musk is, whether you agree with him or disagree with him, agree with his politics, disagree with his politics, whatever. The guy is an interesting individual, and he's definitely going to go down in history as a science mongol. And so as we're kind of watching this, it's like I was streaming a rocket launch on my phone through YouTube with a million other people, and it's like, this is so cool.
I want to correct some terminology for you so you don't have Elon Musk like shooting you later.
Okay.
I believe you mean mogul.
Mogul?
A mongol is a mongol are the people that invaded China.
Yeah. Same thing.
And the rest of Asia.
Listen, Rikai, I've heard it both ways.
Fair enough. But some details on the Falcon Heavy. It is the largest rocket ever launched. A lot of people didn't think it was going to be launched. So it was delayed like 15 fucking times. But they eventually launched it after several more delays during that day because of wind issues. But it is over twice the largest carrying capacity of the next largest rocket that's ever been launched. And now that he's launched it, he's already talking about the BFR, which is the Big Falcon Rocket. You would think it would stand for Big Fucking Rocket. I think he kind of did it on purpose.
I was just going to say that.
But the Big Falcon Rocket is planned to do 6 times the capacity of the Falcon Heavy. And he's already working on that. And it's going to use, rather than 2 boosters, 36 of them.
I am extremely excited about, like, I was excited watching it. I thought it was really cool. And then you start looking at the ramifications and you're like, man, I truly believe that we are within 10 years of being able to take, like, a airplane ride up into space.
I think we're within 5 years of sending humans to Mars.
And maybe.
Elon Musk agrees.
Yeah, leading the way.
The BFR is the rocket he plans to use to send people to Mars. And
so
he plans to have that up and running by early to mid-2020s.
So here's one. Chris and I were talking about this last week or the week before. What if Elon Musk could build us a rocket big enough to shoot garbage into the sun. And we could, like, shoot our garbage into the sun and have the sun burn up our garbage.
I mean, I feel like that's the opposite of what we want to do, because what we want to do is figure out how to get Elon Musk to make us replicators so we can just turn the garbage back into matter to make us new things.
Right, or shoot the garbage into the sun, because that would be really sweet.
Yeah, up until we accidentally somehow explode the sun.
No, come on.
But I mean, I feel like the Falcon Heavy launch was like a historic turning point in human history. Like, I actually teared up watching that launch.
Did you really? That emotion, yeah, evoked that much of an emotional response, huh? I'm not surprised.
Well, the part where I teared up wasn't the launch itself. That was pretty fucking incredible looking. The part where I teared up is where they touched down the reusable booster rockets again.
Yeah, dude. On the same place.
Yeah, seeing those land in the same place they launched from. And not only that, but doing it in tandem. These things that are like several dozens of stories tall that just got launched into the sky and then re-landing them facing, pointing up. That is insane. And the fact that they did it flawlessly on the first try is crazy.
I saw a meme and it said, I spent 4 hours debugging a multi-threaded lock contention bug in a CLI tool. Then I watched two rockets land right up on their assigned landing pads in the exact same position they did before launching a vehicle into space. I quit.
Like, it basically makes you feel like anything you were doing is just fucking dumb.
Yeah, that was incredible. I'm so happy. It's really exciting to live in 2018. I'm super excited. That was really fun.
The good news, Noah, is that was probably running Linux.
Yeah, well, yeah, I would assume so. I would imagine a lot of stuff was running Linux. They had, you know, they had cameras streaming back. They had, you know, obviously all the telemetrics and stuff like that. I'm sure Linux played a part. I'm convinced.
I think one of my favorite things, during the launch, once they had the car floating in space and they had the camera feed coming back, I think Elon Musk said something to the equivalent of, man, if this doesn't prove to the flat earthers that that the earth isn't round, then nothing will, because we have CGI that looks way more realistic than this.
Yeah, but they'll claim that that was all part of the plan. And what does Elon Musk know? He's just some Mongolian.